do turning to today, where the title we've set ourselves is "Where Does UK Foreign Policy Go From Here?" I thought when we said this that we would be looking at post-Brexit. It's an even more interesting subject today because Brexit is still in the air. Where do we go from here? It will be interesting to hear what our speakers have to say. I have three speakers who are all well qualified in foreign affairs. I'm going to call them in the following order. First, I'm not going to introduce them at length because you know them just as well as I do. The first that I will call is Malcolm Rifkind, old colleague of mine, Foreign Secretary, as you know, up until 1997. And then on my right, Jack Straw, who I'll call second, who was Foreign Secretary from 2001 to 2006. I should know that because I was a shadow. And finally, another Deputy Foreign Minister at the same time as I was, he then went on to lead the Liberal Party, Ming Campbell, who I'll ask to sum up. And we'll leave hopefully about half an hour for question and answer. And I will explain that when we get there. Without more ado, I'm going to call on Malcolm Rifkind.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very, very much indeed. Michael made some reference to the fact that we're not yet on the eve of our departure from the European Union. After the Speaker's announcement yesterday, I couldn't help reflect on the Prime Minister's fate. I recall it once being said, as one door closes, another slams in your face. The first time I heard Henry Kissinger speak was in London opening a conference in the 1980s. And he began by saying, "When Adam and Eve left the Garden of Eden, never to return," as they left, Adam turned to his wife Eve and said, "You know, my dear, we are living in an age of transition." So all transitions are around, but some are more dramatic than others. And I want to concentrate on foreign policy. That's our theme today. And I want to look at what's going to happen, particularly on the assumption that at some stage we will leave the European Union. And I think the point I want to make before I come directly to foreign policy is, of course, the last few months have been pretty torrid months for the United Kingdom's reputation in other countries. Fairly or unfairly, most of the international comment has been critical, if I can use a soft word to describe it. I remember, and what I'm about to say applies both to European diplomats, European Union diplomats, as well as our own. I remember reading how Harold Nicholson, a well-known diplomat in the 1930s, said that the worst diplomats, the worst negotiators, are lawyers, fanatics, and missionaries. And he went on to explain, lawyers, of course, say, "I can't do X, Y, or Z. The rules do not permit me." As if somehow governments can't change rules, or European Union can't change rules if it wishes to. Fanatics, well, that speaks for itself. Missionaries, because, you know, it's my faith. How can I compromise on my faith? And therefore, compromise can't be considered. The essence of diplomacy, of course, is compromise. And if we're in a bit of a mess at this moment, the only comment I make on that is it's because there hasn't been enough compromise on either side in order to get a suitable and sensible solution. But let's go straight to the question of foreign policy. And my starting point has to be that if there were some reasons that were not relevant to our departure from the European Union under the referendum, it was foreign policy. It was hardly an issue during the campaign, but it didn't deserve to be an issue. Because although we'd been the odd man out on the single currency, on Schengen, on a whole range of EU initiatives with opt-outs and the like, on foreign policy, we actually have been one of the main constructive contributors and has enabled not a single foreign policy, but a common foreign policy in a whole range of areas where it proved far from impossible to reach agreement, particularly Britain, France and Germany, but also other countries. So, and it's significant that foreign policy hasn't loomed large in the negotiations because it's not the controversial area. However, there is still a huge challenge because not only from the point of view of the United Kingdom's national interest, but from the point of view of the European Union's interest, we both lose substantially if we don't get it right in regard to whether Europe, as a continent's voice, is heard and given due accord in the wider world. And, you know, there is still a question mark how that will happen. I think we will find a way of working closely together. We certainly ought to, because some have, I think, quite unreasonably suggested that our referendum decision showed isolationism or xenophobia or a desire to opt out of the wider world, as if we were some sort of British version of Trumpism. I don't think that was remotely true, because you only have to look at Britain's history, not just over the last 40 years, but over the last 200 years, to see that while we didn't involve ourselves in the detail of continental European policy, whenever there was perceived to be a strategic threat to the stability of Europe by one power seeking to dominate the rest, we immediately joined with the rest to prevent that happening. It happened with Napoleon, it happened with the Kaiser, it happened with Adolf Hitler. All three started off hoping we'd stay neutral. In every case, we actually, on day one, as it were, joined the conflict and helped defeat them. And we did that not out of empathy or sympathy or to show goodwill. We did it because our own judgment of our geostrategic interests were that they would be endangered if that balance of power, yes, I use that phrase, in Europe were to be shattered in some fundamental way. Now, if that's been true in the past, and if it's been true during our period in the European Union, it stands to reason that it will remain true in the years to come. Indeed, that is already proving itself, because in the 2 years since President Trump became President of the United States and has departed from fundamental policy issues on climate change, on the Iran nuclear deal, on international trade, on the Middle East, the United Kingdom government, which in most respects is far closer to the United States than to continental Europe, has desisted from the policy of Mr. Trump, has said we cannot share that view, and has reached the same conclusions as our European colleagues, France and Germany, on Iran, on climate change, on international trade, on Jerusalem, and a range of other options or examples that I could give you. So that's not because of friendship with one or dislike of the other. It's because of our judgment of our national interests and what that points towards. So the question is, how do we do that when we're no longer part of the European Union, no longer part of the Foreign Affairs Council? And there's no simple answer, but there is an answer. And the answer essentially is not to wish to get involved in the minutiae of foreign policy, much of which the EU will go ahead regardless of our views, and it doesn't fundamentally affect our interests. It's on these big issues, on China, on Russia and Crimea, on the Middle East, on attitudes to the United States, not just defence issues, which are through NATO, but on foreign policy issues. How do we deal with these? And basically what I'm suggesting this morning, I've suggested it elsewhere, is an EU plus one. Not an institution, but an arrangement that we come together not to hear what the EU's policy is and be asked whether we agree with it, but that we take part in developing the policy. If we do all agree, that's great. If we don't, they go their way and we go ours. We can't veto anymore. We have no right to do so if we're not a member of the EU. Now, is this unrealistic? I give you an example. It's marvellous to give examples of where it's actually happened. When the question of the Iran nuclear negotiations were taking place, at the appropriate moment, it was decided the people who should handle this on behalf of the international community should be the P5, five permanent members of the Security Council. Perfectly reasonable proposal, but until someone said, but hold on a moment, if we restrict it to those five, that doesn't include Germany. And when it comes to having an impact on the Iranian public thinking, on what sanctions would mean to the Iranian economy if Germany was also involved, and for a number of other obvious reasons, it was quickly appreciated that that didn't make sense. So what was created, and it happened, was the P5 plus one. And that's where I go back to Harold Nicholson's problem with lawyers. The rules didn't permit it, any more than the rules permitted France to remain in NATO when de Gaulle wanted to take them out because he couldn't stand the integrated military structure. The rules said if you can't accept that, you shouldn't be a member of NATO. And it was realised by everyone that we would lose more than we'd gain by a complete departure of France from NATO. And so, in fact, they rewrote the rules. France remained in NATO, not in the integrated military structure, lost influence, of course, but nevertheless participated, and Moscow was not very happy. So there are precedents if the will is there. Is the will there? I'm coming to my final comments. I think the evidence is that it is. I've done a lot of speaking to people and visiting various parts of Europe over the last year or so, particularly talking about foreign policy issues in the future. And I have yet to meet a single person involved in foreign policy, either at official level or at political level, who does not disagree, if we get a deal on the overall Brexit issues, then one of the priorities over the next year will be to not necessarily go to the particular option I've suggested, but in that direction, and to discuss how we're going to do it. So very, very final point. Never let's lose sight of the fact that for most of the world, the big issue, they're all very important issues, but the bigger issue is not whether the United Kingdom is or is not a member of the European Union. The biggest issue is, will Europe speak with a single voice in a world where China, Russia, America, India will increasingly be the big players? And Europe cannot speak with the same authority without Britain as it could with Britain. And the challenge is how we do that in a way that respects the fact that we've left the EU and that we have not the same rights as we had before with regard to what the EU should conclude on matters of that kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Malcolm and Michael. In this temple of liberal imperialism, I thought it would be useful to begin with the well-known quotation from Lord Palmerston, 1848, who said, "We have no eternal allies, and we have no perpetual enemies. Our interests are eternal and perpetual, and those interests it's our duty to follow." So the question is, what are our interests in foreign policy? I suggest they're to keep the people of this country safe and secure, free from armed conflict, terrorism, or organised crime, to keep us prosperous in a growing economy, to underpin and to enhance our civilisation, our culture, and our values, without which life in the UK, even if it was safe and prosperous, would be dismal indeed, and to understand that we have a profound stake in the international order, the rules-based system, which has been developed since the war, and as which has enabled the post-1945 world to enjoy a greater degree of harmony and prosperity than if those institutions had not been in place. Now, Palmerston and his generation also believed in the value of international diplomacy, not least in the concert of Europe. But Palmerston was leader of the world's most powerful nation at the time, and so he could supplement his faith in the rules-based system by gunboat diplomacy, as he most famously did in 1851, when, after the Greek government was proving recalcitrant in paying compensation to Mr. Don Pacifico, Palmerston sent gunboats to the Piraeus and shelled it until the Greek government saw the point. Now, such options are still, in extremis, available to the United States, to China, and to some extent to Russia. They're not available to us. As a medium-sized power, which has since the war sought to exercise a degree of influence in the world disproportionate to its size, we depend critically on the international order and on that rules-based system. I give you just here one example, our seat in the United Nations Security Council. Do not underestimate the trauma, the damage to our sense of ourselves, if our position on the Security Council came under serious attack, still more if it was removed. Difficult, but not impossible. And we have to work extra hard to show how seriously we take the United Nations and how important we see our role within the UN. Now, as Malcolm said, and Michael said, we thought perhaps we'd be discussing the post-Brexit world. We're not, but my view is, whatever my personal regrets about this, is that Brexit will happen, and at some stage the waters will close over, and we'll have to get on with the new reality which we face. That reality includes the imperative to strengthen our relationship with EU member states and with the EU itself. It requires a recognition by us, and to some extent a readiness to use the word exploit rather carefully, but to understand that the EU is going to face its own existential problems of its own. For example, on money. If you look at how the money is distributed, it is not obvious, except for some countries, why some should benefit and some should be contributors. Poland receives 220 euros ahead, Greece 300, Belgium 260. Spain gets 90 euros ahead, Italy has to pay in 70 euros ahead, Germany 120, France 80. Our removal from the EU will place increasing strains on this model, which to some extent has held the EU together. How is the EU going to develop? Will it go the way that President Macron is proposing, by further a degree of centralisation? Or will it go the way that the new leader of the CDU, likely to be the Chancellor, next Chancellor, who I'll call by her acronym, AKK, who is taking a very different view, but by the way, has already proposed that the EU should take over France's seat as a permanent member of the Security Council. That's going to make for an interesting discussion. How is the EU, based on values, going to cope with increasingly majoritarian and authoritarian tendencies in Hungary and Poland, deep corruption in Romania? How will it respond to the perpetual applicant country of Turkey? Now, we do not need to be bystanders in this debate, and picking up what Malcolm says, what we ought to be doing, including by an EU plus one, but by other mechanisms of direct diplomacy, to recognise where our interests lie and to seek to influence what EU member states themselves are doing and are positioning. And we should bear in mind that other countries outside the EU, Russia, China and the United States, seek continually to do this, and often with a degree of success. And I suggest that's what precisely a Margaret Thatcher or a Tony Blair faced with this situation would now be considering. And were we to have, and there's no reason why we shouldn't, leadership of a comparable level, we ought to be able to do the same. In turn, that requires a very significant expansion of our diplomatic effort of the foreign FCO network. I mean, it's a paradox, but ACRET will have to be bigger, the equivalent of ACRET, bigger than it is now, and so certainly will our embassies across Europe. And it goes for our network across the world. And to its credit, the government has recognised that, although inevitably not putting sufficient money into that. I mean, second, we have to underpin our diplomacy by an expansion of both our soft power and our hard power. Britain has done well on its soft power, and we currently rank top in respectable world rankings, rarely dropping below second or third. A combination of our aid programme, work of the British Council, the English language, our universities, our science base, and I suggest our civilisation, culture and values. And we have to explicitly nurture all those. I'm in favour of a high aid programme, but I've never been convinced it should be tied to an arbitrary figure of 0.7% of GDP, established in 1970, 49 years ago, when the world and world GDP was very different. We have to look very carefully at how our overall overseas budget is used. Now, we're not Norway, Sweden or Switzerland, occupying kind of niche diplomatic position. We need hard power too. In that, NATO is the key. We remain at one of only four members who contribute more than 2% to NATO. I don't take the view, despite the rocking of the institution to which it's subject by President Trump, that NATO's days are numbered, nor that the US's support for NATO is numbered too. And if you look at the support for NATO within Congress, amongst both parties, you can see that there is a very severe constraint being exercised on President Trump and his position. But NATO becomes ever more important to the UK, a critical forum for us when we are out of the EU, bearing in mind that most member states are also members. And there are many reasons for that, but one is in terms of handling Russia. Now, we've got to have an intelligent approach to Russia, because they have legitimate interests, which are often, I think, downplayed in the West. They have a GDP of 1.6 trillion US. They're facing a combined GDP of NATO members of 17 trillion. It's a very big difference. On the other hand, NATO has only 515 nuclear warheads available to it. Russia has over 6,000. And it has shown a capacity for asymmetric disruption of democracies and some unacceptable diplomacy and military action of which we have to be alive. In terms of the other relationship, we have, Malcolm referred to this, have to maintain this key relationship with the US, but one which does say, as we have said repeatedly to the US on the Iran negotiations, that yes, we are very close to you, but that doesn't mean we always do what you want us to do, and sometimes we're going to take a very different view from you. But to do that, you can gain an understanding from the United States if we're locked in with them into a very close alliance and continuing dialogue than if we're simply shouting at them. We need this close relationship with the US, as well as, critically, with other major countries, to deal with the new challenges which arise from climate change, arise from China's replication of what France and the UK did famously in the 19th century, which is to seek to disproportionately influence African countries. And we need it in respect of the Middle East, which remains the single most important area of potential conflict for us. And on that, again picking up the point about Iran, we have to ensure we continue to work with our European partners to maintain the JCPOA, not as it were, apologists for the Islamic Republic, for whom I have no brief, and very few of us in this room will have a brief, but to understand that we can influence internal Iranian politics by engagement with Iran. And I take sort of comfort for that view from the fact that the group inside Iran who are most opposed to engagement, most opposed to the JCPOA, are the hardliners responsible for the, for example, their foreign policy in their near neighbourhood. I want to just finish by saying this. Yes, we've been through a turbulent period in the United Kingdom, and it has damaged our reputation abroad. But I've got faith in the British people. I've got faith in its political institutions. At least in the United Kingdom, people haven't had to take to the streets violently, as they have in many other countries faced with a similar existential argument about the future of the country. Why not? Because what people can see is that the arguments, untidy arguments they're having in their kitchens or in the public houses, are also the same untidy arguments which are taking place inside the House of Commons. It is genuinely the cockpit of the nation. And at some stage, it will be resolved. I also just say parenthetically, to those who are worried about Mr. Bercow's pronouncement yesterday, do not fret. The British Constitution is a wonderfully flexible instrument. Large part of the British Constitution is contained in the standing orders of the House of Commons. They're passed by a simple majority. They can be suspended by a simple majority. So should that wonderful moment ever arise when Mrs. May has got the numbers for a simple majority, even one, to get through Brexit, she can, as a prior resolution, she can get through a simple majority to suspend standing orders in order that she can get through Brexit. So it's a bit of a hare, that. I believe, my last point, is that if we're clear-headed about our perpetual interests and engage imaginatively with our allies and our adversaries, then the UK can continue to exercise influence and some power disproportionate to its size. Thank you very much indeed.
If I seem a little nervous, it's because these days Liberal Democrats don't often get the opportunity to speak to so many people at one time. And I have a feeling that this is one of the largest meetings that have been held in the National Liberal Club for quite some time. I don't disagree with anything that's been said, but I have perhaps some rather different nuances. Malcolm said that there had been no detailed discussion about foreign policy because it, I hope I don't paraphrase him unfairly, wasn't necessary. Now that's true, But one of the consequences of the events of the last couple of years is that there's hardly been any serious consideration of so many important foreign policy issues. Let me just remind you, first of all, that the United, in my view, I'm a Remainer, unreconciled. The United Kingdom, in my view, is weakened by leaving the European Union. The European Union is undoubtedly weakened by the United Kingdom leaving it. We have an increasingly assertive, economically, politically, and militarily China. We have the unpredictability of the present occupant of the White House, who could easily continue in that position until 2024. And of course, we have the aggressive approach of Mr. Putin, whose twin policies are the destabilisation of the European Union and the undermining of NATO, not to mention tolerating, and I use that in a charitable expression, the events which took place in Salisbury. Also, we have the fracturing of the architecture of the nuclear arms control system, which was a consequence of the end of the Cold War. The JCPOA has been already referred to by Jack, who knows a great deal more about Iran than I do. But the INF Treaty is at an end, one way or another. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty has still not come into force. And now we hear, certainly in Russian military circles, a description of what might well be nuclear war fighting. Now, these are serious issues which have not had the attention they deserve. And one consequence, I hope, if we remain, is that there can be a far greater focus in the United Kingdom, but together with other members of the continent of Europe. Because the issue which many of these matters raise for us in their multiplicity is of greater risk. The risk of misjudgment, misunderstanding, provocation, real, deliberate, or imagined. And it seems to me that thus far, at least, those who have argued most strenuously for us to leave the European Union have not offered what one could describe as a realistic alternative. Global Britain. I thought Britain was a global country. What is new? What is different? What is being offered? What do we fail to do in foreign policy now that we would do better were we no longer a member of the European Union? I'd be interested in the answer to that question. Some people say a closer integration with the Commonwealth. Well, the Commonwealth, this is a very laudable objective, but you have to look at the Commonwealth with some detail to see, for example, on issues of personal freedom, things like same-sex marriage and other issues of that kind. There is no real integration so far as the Commonwealth is concerned. Some people say of the Commonwealth that this is the obvious opportunity for replacing, in trade terms, anything we may lose from leaving the European Union. There will be some readers of The Guardian here today, I'm sure. Last week you read, I hope, a very interesting article by Mr. Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister of Australia, who dismissed the British government's proposals for increased trade with the Commonwealth in terms which were at once unparliamentary and plural. And he pointed out the fact that after 10 years, no agreement had been struck between Australia and India regarding trade. What I think is important is to try and look ahead as to what kind of cooperation we might find with the European Union. And if you read the papers, if you read the documents, if you read the political proposals, which we've not yet come to and which will may perhaps be more hotly debated than the withdrawal agreement, There's all those warm words we're used to, cooperation, things of that kind. But what we have to remember is we will not be in the room. And when you're in the room, you take part, first of all, by making proposals, by joining in the discussions, by agreeing the compromises that have been referred to, and then owning the decisions. And that will make our position very much more difficult than it is at the moment. We won't have a veto. I'm not sure that that is quite such an important issue, but the one thing is certain, if you're not in the room, then it's very difficult to influence what takes place in the room. And therefore, we will have to look more closely at the things that bind us together. Values shared, a rules-based system. And there is an interesting illustration of a country which is not a member of an international institution. It's Finland. It's not a member of NATO, but it acts as if it were a member of NATO in all respects. In some respects, it's a better non-member of NATO than many of the members of NATO when it comes to considering the contribution it can make to defence. But it doesn't join NATO because to do so would upset the delicate balance with Russia. The United Kingdom outside of the European Union should be as fervent in matters of foreign policy as if it were in my view, if we are to take full advantage of the cooperation which is available and also to satisfy those with whom we wish to cooperate that we can be trusted. We have things to offer for Europe. We are a nuclear power. We have a nuclear deterrent. Both France and the United States are anxious that for no reason should we ever depart from that. We have the largest military budget in Europe. We have the best intelligence capability, which we can exercise without prejudice to the particular role and privileges which we enjoy as members of the Five Eyes. And indeed, even if not with the White House, then we can speak for American interests to Europeans and speak to America for European interests. Perhaps not as closely as we have in the past. A capacity which we had, which was urged upon us as long ago as John F. Kennedy. I don't see any particular distinction in our policy towards Russia, except I think we would do well to stiffen the sinews of those European countries which are being wooed either by offers of energy or intimidated by threats of hybrid warfare, to say that we stand resolutely with them so far as they may constitute a threat to their integrity. We also have, of course, to deal with the issue of China. The United States sees China unequivocally as a rival. But we have to see China in a rather different light, more in a partnership. And I don't think that partnership has particularly helped if at the time of a possible trade mission to China, the Secretary of State for Defense talks about the maiden voyage of an aircraft carrier being carried out in disputed waters. I haven't really dealt with the issue of the United States and the shaking of NATO to which the President is susceptible. But I can point to something else, which is that at a recent meeting of the NATO Parliamentary Assembly, the American delegation was led by Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who went out of her way publicly and privately to assure members of NATO that so far as the Congress was concerned, the Congress rejected any of the reservations being expressed by the President. And if you talk to military establishments in this country, they will tell you that relations with the military establishment in the United States are as good as they've ever been. And they will tell you that the intelligence relationship is as good as it has ever been. So I say from that that we have a contribution to make towards Europe. And that ought to entitle us to have the kind of influence and access which Europe plus one, in my view, would undoubtedly achieve. But there's a gap in the market. In 2020, we have the review conference of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's boiling up to be one of the most difficult occasions in the history of nuclear arms control that we have ever seen. I want to suggest this, and I've talked about the NPT and the CTBT and about the JCPOA. There's a gap in the market. There's a gap in the market for a country with an independent nuclear deterrent to try and return international consideration to the notion of nuclear arms control. And if we are looking for a special role, something of which we have a capability, then surely that would be a good one upon which to embark on global Britain.
Thank you very much. We've had a very interesting set of ideas put to us, everything I expected from, I may say, leading members of my advisory board on global spending reform. You can see why we have such good ideas. I'm now going to open it to the floor. I'm going to call people, and there are two microphones roving. If you can wait till the microphone gets to you, if you could stand up and then introduce yourself, and if you could, because we've got about 20 minutes, keep your questions or comments reasonably brief. Ambassador.
Thank you.
Yes, Cubby.
I am Ambassador of Kuwait. It is so fascinating your discussion today, but I would like to ask Anne to have the opinion of the three great panelists. When they said that now Britain involved with Brexit and this issue weakening its foreign policy, do you think that is right? This is the feeling from Middle East. Well, in the Middle East, when you talk about Britain, they said, well, they are busy with Brexit. They don't have, you know, their hand, as usual, in the foreign policy. The second one, it's connected, because Mr. Stroll and Sir Malcolm and also Lord Menzies mentioned your relations with the United States after Brexit. Is it going to be under Trump the same, or it will be changed? Thank you very much.
Would you like to start with that?
Right, I have 2 points. I would respond to what the ambassador said. I think you are right, Ambassador, that during the period of these negotiations on Brexit, our global influence is reduced. There's simply the diplomatic energy of the Foreign Office and of the whole government structure has been directed primarily to that end. But that needn't be a long-term change, and there's no reason I see why it should be. On the point about US relations and relations with individual countries after Brexit, you know, we lose influence with the European Union, but in some respects, there may be other consequences with other countries. I was speaking a few months ago to a former Russian foreign minister, not the present one, but a former one, and I said, I presume you're going to be less interested in the United Kingdom after we leave the European Union. He said, no, on the contrary, we'll have to devote more resources to studying what the UK, because you're now going to be an independent player. We cannot assume that your view will be the same as the rest of Europe's. It may be different, more helpful to us or less helpful to us. And because you're a permanent member of the Security Council, you remain vitally important in our deliberations. That was interesting.
Yes, gentlemen in the third row on this side.
I think I have to do more soft publications. The world order is changing almost every year. And President Trump saber-rattling with the EU with regards to NATO has prompted Macron and Merkel to actually think of a new defence strategy for the European Union. What's your take on that, please? Thank you.
I don't... For France and Germany and some other member states have been talking for years about getting the European army together and all the rest of it. I don't believe that they will achieve that. More than, I mean, there's some element of you know, European military cooperation, which is used for peacekeeping. But NATO will remain the key alliance for European nations. And aside from anything else, when you look at, leave aside France, whose defence spending is almost at the same level as ours, not quite. But look at Germany's, which is at lamentable, and actually what they spend it on is not very effective. And then other European countries. The idea that somehow the EU, as it's presently constituted, could be a competitor or a substitute for NATO is pie in the sky. So I am relaxed about that.
Certainly pie in the sky. They should be concentrating on capability, not structures, because that is an area in which, if I may say so, President Trump does have a proper story to tell. And there is an organisation called PESCO. It's nothing to do with supermarkets. I won't try and unpick the acronym, but it is designed among European allies to try and be more effective in increasing capability. Unhappily, the kind of things in which it has so far become engaged are not those in which there is the greatest need. So I go back to capability, 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 and let structures wait for quite a long time.
Thank you. Gentle on the aisle, about halfway up.
Thank you. My name is, I think,
works
quite a long time.
Could you introduce yourself?
Sorry, I'm Tony Brenton, I'm a former bishop now. Key role we played within the EU, indeed in the world, was finding common ground between the EU and the United States on whatever the pressing issues at the time were. And I suspect our departure is going to make finding that common ground harder. As many have said, we're not in the room. I am struck by people saying it's pie in the sky, all this European foreign defence stuff. Actually, we've been the chief obstacle so far to it happening at all. And these things, as we all know in the EU, have a tendency to get going faster than many people like. That will inevitably subtract from NATO. America itself, even after Trump, I suspect some of the Trumpian attributes of US foreign policy will stay. So I'd just be interested in your comments on the effect of our departure from the EU on limiting what looks to be like a growing gap between the EU and US foreign policy.
I think the single most important reason, Tony, why the United States is upset by our departure is they saw us as likely to be closest to their way of thinking when EU was deliberating future initiatives. And that's something which is true. Our departure does make it more difficult. But, you know, sometimes a number of countries in the EU have been content to leave it to the United Kingdom to argue a point of view that Berlin or Paris might not have been happy with. And so instead, we always looked as if we were almost isolated. We didn't get support. I remember immediately after the referendum being in the Baltic states, and they were saying, but why are you leaving? We are your greatest allies. I said, well, it would have helped if you put your head above the parapet occasionally and actually publicly said that you share the UK's views on whatever it might be. And in fact, they didn't want to upset Berlin and Paris. Now, our departure in this respect will actually create perhaps a more meaningful debate within the EU as to what the relationship with the United States should be. And that there's at least half the EU members want to pay more attention to NATO than to EU defence policy. At least half, possibly more than that. And they, therefore, will be able to not depend on the UK to be their spokesman in the EU, but they can speak for themselves.
Yeah, and Tony, I mean, one of the arguments that those of us who wanted to stay in the EU used was the obvious one, which was that we were going to lose influence with the US and therefore with the EU free or out of it. However, that's where we are. We've got to do the best we can. And as I said, I mean, this maybe a slightly unattractive point, but I'll make it nonetheless. It is perfectly possible to influence what individual member states in the EU are doing from outside the European Union. I mean, say, Russia has been rather good at that. I'm not suggesting we use all their methods, but simply understanding their internal politics of individual member states, getting alongside them, and sometimes working out how we can develop difficulties and so on, as well as enhance those people who are sympathetic to us, is something we're going to have to do. It does mean there has to be a step change in British diplomacy, both in terms of numbers of diplomats we put into capitals across Europe, because those numbers have gone down because of the EU, and in the imagination which they are showing.
William Wallace.
William Wallace, Liberal Democrat, House of Lords. None of you, until me at the end, mentioned the concept of global win, which was touted as the belief that being in the EU reduced our global influence, and that leaving the EU would mean that we were able to be stronger in the world. Did you not mention it because you think it's nonsense? None of you either mentioned the Western European Union in talking about the EU plus one. Those of you with long enough memories will remember that WU was all about the EEC plus one. And I recall talking to Foreign Office officials who said it was a total waste of time. And really, most people there, including ourselves, thought, why are we at this meeting? Do you think that's a model we can avoid going back to?
Do you want to start?
Well, I mean, if Global Britain means sending an aircraft carrier at the same time as you're trying to have an important trade mission, then I think we've got to redefine global Britain, haven't we? I can't think of anything that we are unable to do globally now that we will be better able to do globally once we've left the European Union. And as for the WEU, it's simply withered on the vine. One of the problems is terminology, because people talk about a European army. But of course, in various parts of Europe, the words European army do not convey exactly the same. And all you have to do is to go back to the maybe 10, 15 years ago when it was, if my memory serves right, the three Ds, duplication, distraction. I can't remember what the others were. But the Americans made it pretty clear at that stage just how much they were disabused about the idea of some form of structure. And as just been pointed out, you build a structure, it will undoubtedly take resources away from NATO. Better cooperation within NATO, common procurement, for example, interoperability, things of that kind, that's all worth trying to do. But not having alternative structures, because they will undoubtedly... Well, I'll tell you what will happen. People who are only just spending 2% will say, well, we can't spend more because we're spending 0.25% on the so-called European army. It will be an excuse for avoiding the NATO responsibility.
Could I just...
What I was going to say was that Global Britain wasn't my idea, but I happen to think it's a good idea. And I wish I'd thought of it myself when I was Foreign Secretary. It's branding. But I go abroad, as we all do, and visit a lot of our diplomatic posts. I think it's been really, really sensible piece of branding to give a bit more coherence to our foreign policy. Now, of course, there has to be some content in the packet, and that's what we've been talking about. But I wouldn't knock the idea at all, William. I think it's a good one.
Just add one point. I think the Brexiteers coined the title Global Britain for another reason. I think they understandably did not want to be identified as isolationists, as little Englanders, rather like Trump trying to withdraw from international policy. And the reality is, although I disagree with most of what they say, they're not isolationists. They do not disagree with most of the views on foreign policy that we've been discussing today. Most of them overwhelmingly believe in free trade. Most of them would share the views expressed on foreign policy issues. They haven't attacked the government because it's taken the European position rather than the Trump position on a whole range of foreign policy initiatives. So I think global Britain was adopted essentially as a defence mechanism rather than because anything was going to be dramatically different by using that slogan.
Gentleman in the middle there.
Thank you very much. My question is for Jack Straw.
Could you introduce yourself?
John Sandwich, independent peer. You hinted that you'd rather move away from soft power in the sense that aid money could be spent in the Foreign Office. Could you comment on the fairly strong lobby for soft power, which is going to be discussed next week, and whether it's going to be more effective against the Russians' dirty tricks, which you also mentioned?
Right. I mean, look, I'm very much in favour of soft power, which I thought I'd said that. But what the current British government, as David Cameron's did, and to some extent we had to do, was to extract ourselves from the constraints of the previous definition of overseas development assistance, which the OECD had set, which was a straitjacket, to recognise that if aid is successful, then you get countries up to middle income levels, you should not have to be spending so much except for on things like disaster relief. And as you know, there's a big debate about what has led to the huge change in living standards in Asia and some improvement in living standards in Africa and how far aid has played a part. Now, you've got to have that debate. You can't just be frozen in time by this definition 49 years ago in completely different circumstances. So what the British government has been doing, and I support them in this, is getting the OECD to change the definition of ODA to make it more flexible and pushing the boundaries anyway so that it now actually covers quite a bit of spending by the FCO and by the Ministry of Defence. But our soft power does not just depend on our aid programme. It depends on a whole range of other things, BBC, World Service, the British Council, the fact that we have the English language, our universities, a fantastic part of that, our phenomenal science and technology base, and our values, for Pete's sake. All of those things are fundamental. And yes, I'd like to see that enhanced as possible, us staying at the top, but also people have got to recognise we want to exercise power and influence in any degree. We have to expand our diplomatic effort. It's absolutely part of the soft power, if you like. It's essential, and we've got to ensure defence spending at a fairly high level.
I've got time for. I'm going to take two questions together, if I may, and then I'm going to ask all our panellists to answer them. First of all, Jeremy Greenstock.
Jeremy Greenstock, I'm a diplomat. Excellent comments, but you've said very little so far about the world of trade for the UK and our economic performance. How do we use foreign policy in that area, because we can't leave it out of the Foreign Office's responsibility?
And Peter Snow, further back.
Peter Snow, telling us how we put our heads above the surface. You know, good for the UN seems a great role in NATO and so on. But I want to struggle to give us a really positive way in which we will gain in terms of foreign policy from leaving the EU. It would be frankly useful to have a definition. Because if you talk about EU plus one, you nibble a bit of the four ways in which you might be able to listen to. If it's something really solid, please.
Thank you, Peter. An easy question to end the session. I'm going to ask our three panellists in turn to reply to those two questions. First of all, Bing.
Well, Remain.
and Jeremy's question.
Well, of course, the Foreign Office and the what used to be called the DTI now live rather closer together in our embassies, don't they, than they did before. And I suspect that if you're in good terms with countries, then they're much more likely to be well disposed to you when you come to argue the question of trade. And it's often the case, is it not, countries that trade together very rarely find it necessary to resort to arms in order to deal with their differences. So I think these two are both sides, two sides of the same coin. And it is notable now, I think, that embassies understand that in a way which perhaps they didn't when you were starting out your diplomatic career.
Jack Straw?
I think the reason, at least certainly I didn't discuss trade as an element of foreign policy, is because the great uncertainty about Brexit at the moment is what kind of trade relationship we have with the EU. If we do end up inside the customs union and inside the single market, then our trade relations with the rest of the world are going to be very different from if we're outside, and so in a sense that's on hold. But I agree with Ming, I mean, and it's striking to me as I visit posts abroad to note how much more conscious, as it were, traditional diplomats from the Foreign Office tribe rather than DTI tribe, Jeremy, are about the importance of trade and investment and seeing that as a key priority in a way perhaps that 30 years ago they didn't. Peter, on your exam question, how do we gain by leaving? Well, I'm, like Ming and I suspect Malcolm, that's one of the reasons why I was against leaving. However, we're going to leave, I think, and we just have to make the best we can. And I, as I said right at the end of my comments, I remain, despite this trauma, I remain optimistic that probably we'll be able at least to maintain the kind of influence and power that we did have in good times when we were within the European Union. But it's going to take a lot of work and it's going to take more money.
Finally, Malcolm.
On Jeremy's question about the links between the Foreign Office and trade, in the time available, I just make one point. I think the single biggest contribution the Foreign Office, with its extraordinary diplomatic capability and its global reach, can make is to be part of the vocal debate why free trade must remain the priority for the international community. I mean, that's where Trump has done the biggest damage in his hostility to free trade and to new free trade agreements for regions as well as globally, and I think the Foreign Office must be part of that debate and not simply say we deal with diplomacy, we wouldn't want to involve it. I'm not saying they do, but that I think they can make an impact because of the presence they have in every country around the world. On Peter Snow's point, I'm afraid you have three remainers behind this desk, so it's difficult to give you an answer, but I think the point I would make is the one advantage that could flow in terms of our foreign policy is at the moment, when the EU Foreign Affairs Council is reaching agreement, you have to get the agreement of 27 countries, and you have therefore quite often end up with either what's sometimes called the lowest common denominator or the highest common factor. Mm-hmm. In other words, you don't get a very coherent foreign policy position. The one advantage of the United Kingdom not being part of the EU in terms of foreign policy is that we can determine what makes sense in terms of our relationship with other individual countries around the world, many of whom may be neglected by the EU, particularly Commonwealth countries, where we obviously have more influence than any other non-Commonwealth country in terms of their overall perspectives, and that could be an advantage if it's handled sensibly.
Well, thank you very much. I think we've had a splendid session today. I've certainly enjoyed it. I think the three tenors have sung full potential. If they will, I will invite them back again next year to see how far we've got along the various paths they've set out today. Can I ask you to thank them all in the session?
Thank you.